This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Get us wherever you get your podcasts from. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, pretty much all of the major social medias. Today, I'm talking about something which, if you know me at all, it's something that you know I get very riled up about, and that's the party boss system, especially the Democratic Party boss system down here in South Jersey. And when I'm talking about that, generally that means I'm talking about the Norcross family. So today I have someone who a couple years ago took a stand against the Norcross family and actually ran against Norcross. And I'd like to welcome to the show Alex Law. Thanks for being here, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
So what made you decide to try to take on this, I guess, a David and Goliath fight would be an appropriate statement. What made you decide to do that?
Well, you know, I looked around, and at the time, Rob Andrews was being investigated. He was the congressman before Donald Norcross for New Jersey's first district, and he was being investigated by the House Ethics Committee for allegations of misappropriation of campaign funds. There was a 60 Minutes special that featured him, and he was ultimately sort of pressured to resign due to those misappropriations of funds. And when that happened, you know, I saw that he was the first congressman in the history of the United States to be in Congress for 20 years and not author a single bill that became a law. And I started to really question, you know, yeah, it made me question sort of what kind of representation our community in South Jersey was really getting. And as I sort of dug into it a little bit more, and with the sort of, de facto coronation of Donald Norcross as the next candidate. I mean, there was a primary, Frank Minor, and Frank Broomall ran against him in 2014. But, you know, within 24 hours of Norcross announcing, every Democratic leader in each town in the entire district had endorsed him. So really an uphill fight there. I started to sort of look into this and was shocked at what I found in terms of the what I would consider graft and corruption and sort of misrepresentation of our community. So I looked around and, you know, it didn't appear that anyone else was wanting to go against them. And I thought, you know what, you know, I could do something about this.
Can you go into a little more detail about the kinds of corruption and things that you saw that really were upsetting to you personally?
Sure. Well, first, you look at in almost all the towns, you have a system that, you know, I sort of characterize as uncompetitive bidding, where you have law firms and engineering firms and other and insurance companies like George's Insurance Company bidding on municipal and county and even state contracts and receiving them, despite the fact that on occasion, you know, these are non-competitive bids. So you have this system where these companies that are either owned by politicians in other towns or are the donors to many of the politicians that the Norcross family supports, they're getting these lucrative contracts with the state. And then, you know, that drew my attention over to the Economic Opportunity Act, which Donald Norcross, when he was a state senator, co-sponsored and became a law. Now, this was a bill that sounds good on paper, right? The idea that, you know, if you create jobs in a community, you get some kind of tax credit. You know, there might be a philosophical disagreement about whether tax credits work or whether they don't, but when they certainly do not work is when it is sort of under the mechanism that this bill set up. And I've said many times that I believe the Economic Opportunity Act is the single greatest piece of graft in the history of the United States, where we saw over $1 billion of New Jersey taxpayer dollars basically flow directly to the Norcross machine and their affiliates. And how that worked was companies like Connor and Strong, like Cooper Hospital, like American Water, like Holtec, what they did was they effectively didn't create very many new jobs at all. They just moved jobs from other towns a few miles away into Camden. And for those jobs, they received over $1 billion in sellable tax credits. When I say sellable, I mean literally sellable. So even if they didn't have a tax burden of $100 or $200 million, like the grants they received would cover, the state would broker the sale of those tax credits at 90 cents on the dollar or some similar figure to bigger corporations like Exxon or Apple that had a much bigger tax bill in New Jersey. And the companies would just keep the cash. And that was paid out over 10 years or is still in some cases being paid out. So when you see horrible things like that happening, you got to do something about it. Now particularly in Camden, why this was so damaging, you know, you have a lot of people who say, well, George included now on his publicity tour, trying to convince folks that this is a good thing. You have folks saying, well, you know, at least there's some money coming into Camden. Don't you see the improvement in statistics there? Doesn't this work? So there's two things that need to be said about that. First, this is not a zero-sum game where it's either you get $1 billion in graft and it does some marginal good or you get nothing. You know, there's third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and unlimited other options in which that $1 billion could have been spent multitudes more effectively. And to that point, it sort of leads me to my second point, that even if there is some marginal benefit to these jobs being moved into Camden, certainly not at the level of cost that New Jersey paid to move them there. But even if there is some benefit, the residents of Camden City are not going to receive it because there is no social and economic infrastructure in the city by which that they would receive that benefit. And what I mean is this: these campuses for these companies that are built in Camden are being constructed such that they're basically gated campuses. People drive in from their homes in Cherry Hill or Marlton or Voorhees, and then they drive out and they spend all their money in Cherry Hill or Voorhees or wherever else. There's no infrastructure of small businesses, of local businesses, by which people are spending money in Camden, stores, restaurants, etc. So any theoretical trickle down from those jobs being placed there, the residents in Camden City just simply aren't receiving. And this program, shamefully, had virtually no benefits for local entrepreneurs to empower residents of the city to improve their own condition. So to me, that was, along with the other municipal and county instances of non-competitive bidding, these were the instances that really pushed me to want to get involved in politics and try to do something about what I saw as a tremendous wrong being done in our community.
Right, exactly. If you walk around the communities of Camden, you know, walk around Parkside, and you do not see any benefit from having these mega corporations being moved into Camden, because there is nothing there. Like, there's not even grocery stores. Like, there's just like little bodegas on the corner occasionally. There is no infrastructure. So you have hit the nail, you know, spot on the head with that there's nothing in this for the actual residents. And they're claiming social justice when in reality, it's just more rich white guys getting more richer and, you know, more powerful, as it were. So
to your point about grocery stores, you know, that was a big criticism. And then they announced this big deal with ShopRite to bring a ShopRite into Camden. Now, put aside the fact that the location they had in mind was entirely inconvenient for almost the entirety of the city, and there was really no reason why Camden residents would go there rather than the ShopRite that was already in Cherry Hill. And I think ShopRite noticed that and realized that, and they pulled out of the deal. So they had this big headline, oh, no, we're bringing a grocery store to Camden. We care about the residents. And then what do you know, years later, the deal never materialized. And that site now has been, you know, sold off to another company that's going to benefit under the Economic Opportunity Act. And, you know, as you looked at the further effects of this, you had big companies buying up huge portions of land in Camden, which has affected rents, which has displaced people, which has made it even more difficult for your average Camden resident to be successful in their city.
Yeah, I understand completely why you felt a passion to run for this. So let's dive a little bit into that. When you decided, okay, this is it, I'm going to try to take on and, you know, take on the cause of actually helping Camden, what kind of reception did you get, A, from the current power structure, and B, from the actual residents of the city?
Well, this my campaign wasn't just about sort of being involved with Camden. And when I try not to use the phrase sort of helping Camden, because this was not fundamentally about helping Camden. One of the things my campaign was about was working with actual residents in Camden and listening to their concerns and helping empower them to solve their own problems. I think there's a big problem in the suburbs where, you know, white folks think, oh, I'm going to come in and save the day. And that's not the case. They're really smart, passionate, intelligent, wonderful activists in the city of Camden that are just being denied the resources and not being listened to enough. So I think when I think about Camden, I think more of collaboration. Okay. And largely, though, in Camden County and the rest of the First District, you know, it's about sort of helping the communities find their voice again. One of the other things that I was really disconcerted about is the fact that in almost every town, the local Democrat meeting has been canceled, sort of permanently canceled. So the only engagement that people have through the town is the Norcross appointed Democratic committeemen that go to a county meeting that is highly supervised and highly controlled. And sort of bringing back this engagement where communities actually have a say in the representation that they have. So you asked the question. So what did I do when I started? How did I sort of think about this? So first, I've coached hundreds of candidates since my campaign. The first thing you have to think about is how many votes do you need to win? And then how much money do you think you can raise? And from there, you can sort of figure out, okay, what is going to be my cost per vote? And this is ultimately the number that drives your success in politics. Now, when you're thinking about, okay, what does a normal candidate spend per vote in a congressional race? Somewhere around $50 a vote, which I know is shocking. Many incumbents spend up to $125 to $150 a vote. Again, shocking, insane that it costs that much to get Americans to vote. But that's the reality of it. For our campaign, we wanted to do things a little bit more efficiently. Now, I don't think it's theoretically possible to get much lower than a cost per vote of around $2.50 in a competitive primary. So, you know, we shot for $3. And we started to look at, okay, you never needed more than 18,000 votes to win a primary in the first congressional district. So we were trying to get 23,000. So we started to think, okay, this means we have to raise somewhere in the neighborhood of $70,000. And that's kind of how we backed into it. So then we looked at each town. We created a system for targeting voters in every town as efficiently as possible. And every town had a different model. And we started to engage voters in those towns by door knocking, by sending mailers, by making phone calls. And every time we spoke with a voter, we tried to make those touches more efficient. So when we learned something about them, we made sure next time we talked to them, we talked to them about that issue. Additionally, we tried to make sure we had a structure in place to make sure that volunteers that we got, we were able to retain. Because one of the biggest problems for grassroots organizing is you have excited volunteers come in and there's nothing for them to do, and then they go back to their life. So we created a system by which we were able to retain those volunteers and make sure they always had something to do to help the campaign, which is how we were able to drive such huge efficiency. And when the campaign was over, although we didn't win because it was the biggest turnout in the history of the district by almost three times, sort of outside the standard deviation that our model could predict for, we got over 23,000 votes, and we did it at $2.63 a vote, which, as far as I can tell, is about as efficient as anyone's been across the country in a competitive primary in the last 20 years.
See, to me, that's so amusing that those numbers sound so huge, since I do not ever support either duopoly party. I only run really grassroots campaigns, and where you really spend pennies a vote. So, like, the idea of even spending, like, $3 a vote sounds so, like, out of reach for a lot of campaigns, but I love your, like, very systematic approach that you applied to that. That is something I think that stretches outside of just a primary and into if you're running, you know, as a green or as a socialist or as just a purely independent. A lot of those same systems and those same critiques you have apply across every, no matter how you're running. So I think that's a great system, and that there is a lot to be learned from your campaign in that regard.
Well, I think oftentimes what I would call sort of idealistic candidates that are in not for, you know, power, not for a career, but are in it because they feel passionate about a certain set of ideals or issues. They often think, well, if I just say my ideas well enough, people will get it. and then they'll vote for me. And the problem with that is they won't. And you need to have a system in place by which you can formally introduce those ideas in a trackable and repetitive way to voters so that you can really engage them in a way that will make a difference. People don't want to pay attention. You have to make them pay attention through really good organizing, through really effective engagement of volunteers, and through, you know, really innovative messaging.
You're right. Like that, I think that is a very good critique that aside from A, if you're not, don't have some sort of system, no one hears your really great ideas. So even if they were going to be inspired by your great ideas, if they never get the chance to hear them, you know, they're just going to go and vote for, you know, down the column or whatever. But that there does need to be a way to get that out there, that ideas alone will not carry the day. Is there anything else about your system you'd like to go into before I get into sort of the reactions you got from the community?
I'm happy to answer any questions you have about reactions or otherwise.
Okay. When you were out there engaging, or your volunteers were out there engaging with the community, what kind of reception were you getting from actual residents in these communities? Was it they were reluctant or at first, or did you resonate right away with them?
I think Americans are generally very happy to see young people getting involved in politics. It makes people feel excited that a new generation wants to take responsibility, wants to be engaged, wants to be involved. And even if they don't ultimately end up supporting you, I have found most Americans to be very receptive and excited to see young people being involved. And in addition to that, I think most Americans are very excited to see anyone take the time to come and talk to them about their ideas and listen to them about what they care about. So when we came to folks' house and we knocked on their door, or we called them with a real person on the line, and not to sort of talk at them, but to talk with them, I think that was almost universally well received. And I had conversations with people who might have been registered as Democrats, but supported Donald Trump. I had conversations with people registered as Democrats who might have supported Jill Stein. I talked to people across the political spectrum, and I had really good conversations with all of them, because I think having that dynamic of listening, of going to talk with people rather than at them, I think most Americans are very receptive to that.
But I'm assuming the current power structures went on the attack against you a bit, right?
Certainly. I think in the last couple months of the election, I probably had 20 flyers sent to my house sort of telling me what a bad person I was, sent by Super PAC, sent by Donald Norcross's campaign. We were sort of, despite it being a violation of the bylaws, banned from going to the Cherry Hill Democrats meeting. The Norcross pulled out of the debate the night before. We dealt with our fair share of issues like that. But that's to be expected.
Do you have any idea how much Norcross and assorted PACs spent trying to defeat you with your, you know, $2 a vote, how much they spent a vote for to defeat you eventually?
So his campaign spent somewhere around $2 million, and of which he had to take out a mortgage to sort of give his campaign more money in the last few months. And PACs and super PACs, I don't know exactly, if I had to guess, somewhere between $1 million and $1.5 million additional dollars on top of that.
Okay, so we're looking at well over $3 million compared to, what was your total again that you had?
66,000.
Okay. And I don't know the exact vote totals, but you did really well. You did astoundingly well. What was your total votes that you got?
We got just shy of 24,000 votes.
Okay. So you definitely exceeded your goal. If it had been a normal year, you know, who knows, you could be a senator right now.
Well, congressman, but there's an element of it that it was a presidential year, but even in like 2008, which was a huge turnout year, this was you know, more than double the turnout in 2008. So it was a really unusual year. I think we really woke something up in the community, and we pushed them to spend so much money. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to predict when the turnout is so much larger than ever, ever before, but, I'm proud of the campaign we ran. I'm proud of, how much, engagement we did in the community. I'm proud of the fact that, you know, Donald Norcross went from the most conservative voting Democrat in his first term in Congress to after our election, realizing he was vulnerable to sort of a challenge from the left. He's now become one of the most progressive voting members from the New Jersey delegation. So we really moved his vote. Now, I think it's pretty apparent that that's he doesn't actually feel that way, and it's ingenuous, and it might switch back when he doesn't feel so much political pressure. But, you know, at least we got some good votes out of him through the work that we did. And, you know, I think it was good for South Jersey to have that kind of challenge and to really be pushed to think about this machine and what they do and what the kind of representation people want.
Absolutely. So what have you been doing since then? Are you still engaged? Do you ever think you'll run again?
Well, so after the campaign, I did some political work with other officials in New Jersey. And then I also did some strategy advising for folks that owned private businesses. And then I decided that I wanted to go back to law school to sort of increase my ability to engage communities and to do as much as I can. So I'm currently at University of Virginia School of Law down in Charlottesville. But I have been involved. I have been actively coaching progressive candidates across the country. I have been engaged with some of the progressives in South Jersey and sort of helping their efforts in organizing here. And, you know, I don't know if or what I'll run for again. I think that, you know, when my wife and I settle down and choose a community that we're going to be in, I think it's inevitable that I'll want to get involved in some capacity, whether that's local government, whether it's county or state or Congress or whatever. But, you know, I don't have a timeline for that, and I don't have a particular position in mind. And I think for anyone listening, you know, if you're thinking about, hey, I want to run for this or I want to do that, you should think about, you know, what position do you think you could do the most good in? What position does your community need you to do? And let that be your guiding star in determining that. When I ran for Congress, it wasn't because I had some burning desire to be a congressman. It was because I felt that the Norcross name, you know, if we could take that down, if we could do the best we could against them, that would show that this machine isn't invincible and that, you know, other people in the community would then feel empowered to take them on. You know, ultimately we didn't win, but that was the idea. And I think if you use that, you know, where does your community need you? You know, that'll set you up for success.
I think that's great advice. It really is. And I think I think times have changed a little bit since you ran as well, that more people are feeling safe and comfortable openly critiquing the Powerball structure. Now, they still haven't taken it down yet, but I think that there is more just grassroots activism around, hey, we're not being represented by our representatives here. So I think that the climate, you know, and I think you had a part to do and, you know, a role in that of people are saying, hey, wait a second, why is Norcross getting rich off of the residents of Camden? So I really wanted to thank you for kind of opening those floodgates a little bit, showing some cracks in the armor, as it were.
Well, I think you're right that, that people are speaking up more. And if my campaign had a small part to play in that, I'm happy to have done it.
Did you have any other final closing words or advice for people that are thinking about running a very grassroots sort of candidacy, even possibly less of a budget than you had, for example?
Well, I think you need to be realistic in that if you're going to run for something, I really think that you should run for something with the intention of winning. Because if you don't have a plan to win, No one's going to, if you don't believe in yourself and you don't have a plan to win, then you're not going to be able to get voters to believe in you, and you're not going to be able to get supporters to volunteer for you. So you can have less of a budget, but, you know, go through that kind of thought process, figure out how many votes you think you're going to need to win, and figure out how much money you think you can raise, and sort of back into it from there. And if you don't think you can raise enough money, well, then get creative with it and figure out how you can do it. And if you don't think you can get that many votes, well, then maybe consider running for a smaller office first, to get engaged. I think that we need good people. We need people that believe in something, that have that idealistic sort of core where they have a set of ideals that they're getting into politics for. We need those people in politics, and we need them to get into it. So if you're one of those people, think about where you can win, think about your plan to win, and put that together so that way voters and supporters will have every reason to believe in you, vote for you, and support you.
I think that's awesome advice. Thank you so much for being here today. I've really enjoyed, you know, everything that you've had to teach us and to talk about your campaign. And I think I'm expecting I'll be hearing from you again, that you will be running for something if you do decide to settle in South Jersey. I think I'll see your name on the ballot again, probably.
Well, thank you for having me. And I'm always happy to chat about politics. If you out there are thinking about running for something and you want some feedback or advice, feel free to message me on Facebook at AlexLawNJ. I sort of made a deal with myself when I was a candidate and I was out there looking for advice and people wouldn't take my call or take my message. And I just didn't think that was right in the spirit of sort of like helping people be engaged in our country and in politics. So, you know, if you're a candidate out there and you want to run for something and you want some advice about it, message me and I will get back to you.
That is so awesome. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you for having me.
To my listeners, thank you again for joining us here today. We appreciate you so much, and we would be nothing without you guys. We are here for the activist community, for those people that are trying to change things, who see the wrongs in the world and want to be some small part of righting them. That's what we're here for, is you guys. And we do have to keep asking you, since we take no corporate money here at NJRR, if you can go and contribute either through PayPal or through Patreon, even if it's just a couple of dollars a month. That's what keeps us on the air here at NJRR. We appreciate you so much. The future's yours to create. Go out there and create it. Thank you.